Alrighty, here I am today, or today,
Today-o.
today with Dale Carruth, who presently lives on the Gold Coast
True.
and who is going to share and talk to us today about the ins and outs of psychedelic therapy, I
Right.
believe.
Okay. Is that what we're going to talk about, is it? Okay. We can do that.
And you are shortly to release a book, I hear, Dale.
I am,
What
yes.
is your book called?
It's called Transformations: Healing Trauma with Psychedelic Therapy.
Okay. So I would imagine you know something about trauma and
Oh,
how to
yes.
heal and treat trauma.
I actually know way too much about trauma, actually,
Okay.
Julian, unfortunately. But as they say, you turn your lemons into lemonade, right?
So maybe you can share with us a bit about your story and how in your life it brought you to this point.
Sure. Okay, well, there's life before ayahuasca and life after
Maybe talk
ayahuasca.
about life before ayahuasca.
Okay, well, life before ayahuasca, I was 20 years clean and sober in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, for those that don't know. And I had done a lot of work on myself already. I'm also a qualified therapist. I was mainly specializing in addiction, specifically benzodiazepine addiction and detoxification. So that's a prescription anti-anxiety sleeping pill.
And you've written a little book about, a little booklet
Yes, I
about
have.
how to treat benzodiazepine addiction as
True.
well.
I wrote this little booklet about 20 years ago when I was working for Tranks. We were basically a counseling and detox service for people addicted to benzodiazepines. So this booklet was to help people that were withdrawing from benzos. And in my work with psychedelic therapy, obviously with a lot of the medicines I work with, people have to get off prescription medicines before they're actually able to take any of the plant medicines because they have contraindicated effects, or they decrease the effects of the medicines that I work with. So I decided to publish this book mainly to help people that I'm working with to detox off, benzos specifically, because a lot of people these days are addicted to either antidepressants or benzodiazepines. So that was part of the process.
All right, so tell us more about who you are and where you've come from and who you've been in the world, I suppose.
Well, I guess like a lot of traumatized people, I've done a lot of things because we tend to do that. I'm from New Zealand and I've done a variety of things apart from being a therapist. I was also a real estate agent for about 10 years. And I've done a lot of other things as well. But how I came to be where I am today, I was, as I said, clean and sober, but I was still suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And, that whether you're sober or not, that's a debilitating thing which affects pretty much every area of your life. So I got to a point, I had researched ayahuasca for about 3 years, but because I was in AA, in AA, if you take a mind-altering substance, it's considered to be a relapse. So, when you've
Even
been,
though the founder of AA, Bill, is
yeah, Bill Wilson.
Bill Wilson, was basically completely inspired by LSD, wasn't he?
Absolutely. An actual fact, something I read just recently, the whole AA program was inspired by a belladonna experience that he had. So he actually had a vision of AA after he had done belladonna for a treatment, which is another psychedelic, which is not
Not
commonly
really well
used.
known,
But so really, the whole foundation of AA sprung out of a psychedelic experience, but.
So it's not quite drugs or some intoxicant like the AA people at the meetings think it is,
actually. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, this is the problem. You know, the drugs and psychedelics are commonly kind of foisted together as one and the same thing, which those of us that have used them know that they're not, you know.
I think that's changing.
It is changing,
quite quickly people were kind of grokking that they are different,
yeah.
You know. There are, like, the people kind of holding out and not able to make that differentiation. But I think in general, society's kind of getting that message. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one would hope so by now. But, you know, the more books that come out and the more we educate people, and, you know, part of the reason I wrote my book, it was inspired by my own experience. Mm. And I had a big dilemma about taking psychedelics in recovery, because I risked losing, I mean, AA had pretty much become kind of like my family, my tribe. As something was just such a foundation part of my life that, you know, I risked all of that at that time. But, you know, now more and more people from recovery are actually coming into the psychedelic community for healing. Mm. And so it's becoming more of an issue and more out there. And there is actually a group called Psychedelics in Recovery that have started up.
Okay, and I didn't know about that.
Yeah, you didn't?
No.
Oh, really? No. Oh, well, it started in America and it's international. They're doing Zoom meetings, probably inspired by COVID. But so there is a big tribe of, you know, AA, NA people that have found that psychedelics have worked to heal their trauma. And so they've started up this group, Psychedelics in Recovery. So it's for people that still want to do the 12-step program, still go to those places.
Yeah.
But still within some capacity do psychedelics to heal.
So there's something really to be said about the AA community as like a kind of a modality of healing itself, because I think in terms of drugs and alcoholism, a lot of people, we live in quite a disconnected society, and I think from what I understand, AA is like a network of people, like a global network of people who are supporting each other, which is really powerful.
It's incredibly powerful. Mm. It's almost like a divinely inspired program. It really
divinely
is.
Divinely inspired by drugs.
Yes, divinely inspired by psychedelics. The magic little things that they are. Yeah, I mean, you know, we are tribal people when we've lost that. And one thing that AA brings back is that, you know, kind of a tribal affinity, but nothing to do with religion. Like, the only other tribes that are available out there are like going to church or, you know, and most of us don't really want to do that because we know it's pretty much a load of crap.
Yeah.
And, you know, although AA is a spiritual program, it's not religious. And the focus is on really about becoming a better person, living comfortably in your own skin so you don't need to drink or take drugs to feel good. It's about changing your behavior. You know, it's about, there's a saying, when you point the finger, there's three pointing back.
Mm.
And, you know, AA is about taking care of the three pointing back. So it's kind of about taking responsibility for your own behavior.
And having some accountability in a network of people.
Mm. Yeah. So there's a lot more to it than the drugs and alcohol.
Yeah,
it's a spiritual program. Yeah. And it's you know, there's so many branches of it now with, you know, ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, Al-Anon. Oh. You know, there's an A for everything.
Okay.
Yeah, so there is a chapter in my book specifically focused on, you know, AA and NA and psychedelics.
Right, right.
Just the dilemmas that those us people face.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but psychedelics saved my life.
Right.
And I was suicidal, as you well know, because I flew from New Zealand to Australia to do my first ayahuasca ceremony in 2017, and that was with none other than yourself. and you know probably the state that I was in back then.
Well, Dale put me on the spot a little bit, talking on the phone, saying that if this didn't work, she was going to kill herself. Just a little bit on the spot.
Did you get performance anxiety?
I didn't. I was cool, calm, and collected. And you know, everyone's got their own decisions to make in life, and your decisions didn't.
That's right.
And it didn't, you know, you're your own person.
That's right. Do you come across many people like that in what you're doing with?
I don't think I've had anyone before or since who's sprung that question on me.
Is that right? Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating.
Maybe they might think it, but they wouldn't tell me.
Okay. You know. Well, maybe I thought you
needed
a challenge.
But the good news is that you didn't hang yourself and that you're alive and kicking.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, and trying to do good work in
the
world.
So how did that initial ayahuasca experience affect you? What benefits did you get from it?
Well, there was an immediate effect, as in when you've got PTSD or complex PTSD, which I cover in my book as well, what that is. And, you know, look, personally in the work I do, every second person I work with is suicidal. So this is something I work with on a regular basis. And a lot of people that have PTSD get to that jumping off point where if they don't find something, they are going to take themselves out. And, you know, look, I'm not a lawbreaker. I'm just a regular human being just trying to do life. But when you find something that works, you can't, and you know that people are suffering and you know what it's like to suffer.
Yeah.
You can't keep it to yourself or you shouldn't keep it to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we need brave people to fucking, oh, sorry, I didn't want to swear on it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. Okay. Sorry,
the
mum.
The kids in the back seat, their ears are bleeding from the profanities coming out of your mouth, God, Dale.
Yeah. So basically how it affected me, as after I had done it, I noticed that one of the main symptoms of PTSD is hypervigilance. It's that, you know, living on edge, you're so wound up, you react all the time. You're defensive, everything triggers you. And that calmed completely after doing ayahuasca. I was like able to make considered responses. I had like those few seconds grace rather than just reacting to something. Right. It gave me time to actually think about a response and decide, do I want to react like that or do I not want to react like that? And, you know, even just something that sounds so simple is quite life-changing because, you know, you become quite volatile to the people around you. And my mother noticed an immediate change in me. She was stunned. My mother is as straight as you can get. I don't think she's even had a cigarette in her life. And
she never touched alcohol to her lips.
Well, she has had the odd drink, but she's, you know, she's pretty straight. And she even talks to her friends about ayahuasca because she's seen the changes in me. Okay. And if she has friends that have children that are, you know, going through stuff, I've been amazed that she's actually mentioned that to them. So the other changes, I don't know, it just shifted me out of the reality I was in in regard to, you know, you realize how much you don't live true to yourself in life. You know, like I was a real estate agent and I was focused on making money. You know, and that's another thing that happens to traumatized people is that we feel so bad on the inside. We have to do something that makes us look good on the outside. And, you know, real estate, money, making money, that's all, you know, that's where you get your brownie points in society. But you realize it kind of kills your soul as well, just working like a robot and having no internal satisfaction and feeling good about what you do. Like the work I do today with, you know, as I said, it's illegal. I admit it's illegal. Yes, I'm breaking the law. But the reality is I'm saving people's lives. And, and they say that. Look, my book, there's three parts to my book, but the middle part is my client's story. So they tell their own stories in their own words. And there's like 28 people and they talk about what inspired them to do this treatment. They're regular middle class, everyday people, doctors, lawyers, policemen, IT people, social workers. You know, they're average everyday people. They're not hippies. They're not druggies. Half of them have never had a drug in their life, you know. So, you know, I can feel good about the work I do and I know it's making a difference in the world and, you know, you can move on and become who you were meant to be, you know, and become yourself. And, you know, like there comes a time, and I can't remember who said this saying, but it is in my book, but my memory's a bit shot. You know, if a law is unjust, then we are bound to break those laws. Yeah. Like we are obliged to break those laws.
I remember that saying. Yeah.
I think
yeah.
was it Benjamin Franklin? I'd have to look up
my Yeah, book. Yeah. It's we have a the quote goes, we have a duty to break unjust laws.
Correct.
And I actually wrote this down a little bit of paper once.
Oh, did you?
This exact quote. And maybe I'll put it on the show notes because we don't want to Google it right now, but I wrote it down a little
bit. Well, just buy my book because it's the first sentence.
Oh, really? Okay.
First sentence in the introduction.
But do you remember the quote there? Jeez.
I know.
But I wrote it down on a bit of paper and a little bit of paper. And one time, customs, when I came back into Australia, they fully did me over. You know, this was when I had a little bit of heat on me at the time. And they had all these papers and stuff like this, and they went away with all my documents and papers and things, and a little bit shaken, and then they came back with the little notepad with that quote written on the top, just hanging there.
Okay, hung.
They looked a little bit white and still, and just kind of let me go.
But look, you know, I don't know. There may or may not be consequences, but the reality is, you know, that's another thing I've learned in AA is to thine own self be true. And I don't, you know, I feel scared sometimes about what I do and the fact that I have to break the law to help people, the fact that they have to break the law to get help.
Yeah,
you know, it troubles me, but I know morally I feel very right about what I do.
Yeah, I think we've got to understand why the laws exist in the first place. It's because in America in the late 60s and early 70s, they felt that LSD was a very destabilizing influence on society, so they banned every psychotropic drug, and every country in the world signed a declaration that every psychotropic drug known was to be banned in a UN declaration. And so it's just a blanket ban,
yeah.
You know. So I don't think these laws are actually – they're not – ultimately, I think we need to ascertain, are we doing good in the world, you know? Are we doing good, you know, or are we, you know, harming people, right? And I think, you know, if you're someone who is being like a heroin supplier or selling heroin,
yeah,
you can't justify that.
Absolutely not. You absolutely know, not.
You can't say you're doing good. But I think in terms of psychedelics and psychedelic therapy, I think it's becoming very clear that people were benefiting enormously. And they didn't know about psychedelic therapy in the 60s. This is like 50 years ago now, you know?
Yeah. Well, they did actually know about it because they were doing it before.
Oh, yeah, but it wasn't like...
Yeah,
but... It wasn't Cary Grant. It was very small. It yeah, wasn't like, yeah. You know...
Well, I think there's another component to that, and it's not just because... And I cover this in the book. You know, there's a whole chapter on the history of psychedelic therapy, which covers Australia as well. Mm. But it is about the fact that, you know, if you have a look at what Big Pharma are doing, and because I worked in the benzo industry, I know a lot about Big Pharma because I've researched them. But, you know, if you find something that cures people, they don't need to take drugs every day, like benzos and antidepressants. So, you know, these drugs are big business for Big Pharma.
Yeah,
I believe they had a big part to play in this banning of these substances because, you know, they had people that were on these drugs for years getting healed and cured and so there's their meal ticket kind of.
Well, they don't have anything for depression that works. That's the thing. I think that's why psychedelics are coming to the forefront, because it's all, you know, none of the antidepressants actually heal depression.
No.
They just bandage it and they just numb you out. And no, I hear stories from people who get a lot of benefit from antidepressants for taking them a few months, 6 months, which is what they're designed for.
Absolutely.
Not for years and years and years. That's wrong. You know?
Well, you know, they probably saved my life at one point in time too, because I was on antidepressants for 14 years before I had to come off them to drink ayahuasca, obviously. Yeah. But when I first went on them, I needed them. They saved my life.
Yeah.
But the trouble is when you go on them, you actually can't get off them.
Yeah.
I tried several times to come off them, and you know, they say they're not addictive, but they do, they change your brain. They change something.
And you feel
in your
like
brain.
After you did the ayahuasca, there was no way to go.
I've never touched a drug. I've never touched an antidepressant.
Yeah.
I've had the occasional microdose after a heavy duty ayahuasca session for depression, but I've never taken an antidepressant since. That's 5 years now, and I was on them for 14 years, that has to say something.
Yeah. And so after you had that initial experience, what was your journey like, and how did you find the benefits of other you experimented and took other things and explored a bit in the Australian scene?
Okay. Well, I did my flew over from New Zealand to do my first two sessions, and I went back to New Zealand. And I became very fascinated, which I was. Like, ayahuasca called me. It invaded my consciousness for 3 years before I actually did it. So there is a saying that ayahuasca calls you, and I 100% that absolutely happened to me. And so some months later, I can't remember how long, but probably about 6 months later, I decided to move back to Australia because I was fascinated. Because I was a therapist, so, you know, to find something that does so much healing in such a short amount of time, I became extremely curious. And so I came back here, I did more ayahuasca, and then, you know, I believe that once you come into contact with these medicines, then synchronicities and magic kind of starts happening, and I was just led into this path. I didn't come here with any plans to become a psychedelic therapist. I was given, you know, something I would never have thought that I would ever touch. I was given a quantity of MDMA, and I tried it, and it blew my mind. Like, it really did. I just knew this was like a magic key for healing trauma. In a most beautiful, loving way, not a traumatic way like ayahuasca can be. Personally, I find ayahuasca extremely traumatic. Mm. And I don't know whether that's just me, but I think a lot of traumatized people find it traumatic.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is something that's not discussed a lot in the scientific literature, that, you know, they talk about, oh, psychedelics are going to cure everything and heal everybody, and they don't actually cover how traumatic the process can actually be.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, this is partly what inspired my book, is that I'm, you know, I think it's a long way off before psychedelics become legal in Australia. Mm. So part of this book is aimed at the underground, and it's kind of like some protocols and procedures about how to provide safe psychedelic therapy, underground psychedelic therapy, so that, you know, well-intentioned people out there that are doing it just have a little bit more information and knowledge about trauma, for one, about processes and procedures, about how to do a proper assessment so that they're not endangering people, so they know what they're dealing with, they know what type of traumas might come up for people. And integration, which is another thing that's pretty lacking in the underground here, is that, you know, people have these kind of mind-blowing experiences and then are left to deal with the fallout or, so I just think it's important to have some focus on, you know, that psychedelic therapy is a three-stage process of assessment, medicine work, and integration. Without sounding like a scientific kind of model. But yeah, there's a lot not covered in all the hype that's going on at the moment.
Yes. So let's talk about, I guess, how you see things in the world at the moment. I think it's quite interesting because I think that what we're going to see is perhaps the above ground models that may come in the next 5 years or so might not necessarily be accessible to many people.
That's right. And I'd just like to finish what we were talking about before, because I got a bit sidetracked there, but the process that I went through, I came back, did more medicine, the doors kind of opened with people coming my way, being an AA, you know, coming across suicidal people, giving them another option that wasn't presently available to them. And, Yeah. So anyway, there's probably more to cover on that.
Okay.
We'll leave that for now. Yeah, and what was your question around, like?
Yeah, just how I think a above ground rather than underground model is looking like, because I know you might know more about this than me, because I know in the States, for example, the MAPS model, you have a male and a female therapist, and it's going to cost quite a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And it might not be accessible to everyone.
Correct.
And they have quite strict protocols, like you might not even allowed to touch your client, for example.
You
didn't know that.
I didn't know that. No. God, help us.
Yeah.
You know, look, the MAPS model is a research model. It's a funded model. Mm-hmm. No one actually, to my knowledge, has to pay for that treatment because it's a funded research model.
Right.
But the reality is, you know, they're doing 8 to 12 hour sessions. Mm. The client sleeps in the clinic overnight.
Mm-hmm.
If this model was paid for, you're paying for two therapists for like 12 hours at most average psychologists charge between $200 to $250 an hour.
Yeah.
So let's work that out. Mm. Like two therapists for, say, even 10 hours.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's plus the medicine, plus the space, plus all the other people involved.
Mm.
You know, I believe it's, I heard someone, was it Rack, saying that it's like $6,000 per treatment or for two treatments or something like that. You know, look, most traumatized people are just hanging on, really. They're not going to be able to afford to pay that kind of money for treatment.
Yeah.
I think the underground will prevail, even if it does become legalized,
because
it won't be affordable for people.
Well, Frederica in Switzerland, she would work in groups of people.
Yeah.
Because she said, if I worked one-on-one, people would not be able to afford perform me.
Yeah.
And so she would work with small groups of people.
Yeah.
And I did a podcast with her in early 2020, and she talked about, she's like a little bit like the opposite of MAPS. So she'll hold people in her arms and like mother them, like
absolutely
really bring them a lot of comfort.
Yes.
You know? And so do you touch people during the session?
Absolutely. We discuss that in the, you know, prior to doing the session, like because working with traumatized people, you kind of need to seek permission beforehand. Is that something? Do they mind being touched? Do they want to be touched?
Yeah.
And generally during a session, people will ask, you know, I've had one girl hold my hand for 4 hours.
Wow.
You know, and my sessions are generally around 4 hours or 5 hours.
Yeah.
One person can't really hold space on their own for much longer than that. But, yeah, I mean, I guess when you're working underground, you try to accommodate the people that you're working with. So you make the sessions, you know, to a time frame that works for them. And, yeah, I hold people's hand. I'll give them a hug. Stroke their arm, whatever, you know. This is so far removed from traditional therapy that it's going to be really interesting to see how this all works out. There's so many rules and regulations around what a therapist can actually do, and there's so much red tape. And
it seems to me the overground model is rather strangulated and constrained, and I think there's good reasons for a lot of the rules and regulations that they, many of the rules and regulations they have, but it's almost like it's gone a bit too far.
Yeah.
And they're quite limited. Because what you're dealing with in the psychedelic space is like a deeply intimate, vulnerable, open consciousness.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really, I don't think I'd, even if I had the option, I don't think I'd want to work in a above ground space, because there's so much red tape and rules and regulations, and you know,
do you think it could be effective, like an above as effective as how people were working in the underground?
Look, it'll be more effective than what's available right now.
Yeah.
Will it be to its – will it meet its potential benefits? Look, I think what we've got with psychedelics is better than anything by a country mile that's on offer.
Yeah.
So, yes, it will benefit people, but, yeah, I don't know. There's so much unknown with that, and it's a whole minefield at the moment. Like, you know, you've got the likes of Mind Medicine Australia running a therapist training program. And admittedly, I'm sure they would like it to be different, but because of the legal constraints, they're training people to do this therapy who have never actually taken the medicines.
Well, presumably, well, a lot of them would have taken them.
Probably, yeah. Look, I would say most of them have. Like, no one's really going to have a passion and interest for the work unless they've actually done a little.
Yeah.
So you have to hope that that's the case. They're operating within the constraints that they're, you know, trying to operate in. And, you know, I think their intentions are good. And I think that anything that heads in the direction of legalizing these substances, whether it's just for them to work with it or not, it's still a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
You know, there's a bit of infighting that kind of goes on, but
Politics is part of the human condition. Whenever, like, three or more are governing, you get politics. So you've got a bit in your book called The Road to Heaven is Paved with Good Intentions. No, it's The Road to Hell, not The Road to Heaven.
Yeah, get it right, Julian. Get it right. The Road to Hell is Paved with Good Intentions. Yeah, look, I really debated about putting this chapter in my book, and I think it's needed. I'm probably putting my life on the line a little, but, you know, it is starting to cover some of the things that can go wrong and do go wrong, which, because of, you know, most people are too afraid to talk about this stuff. One, because they don't want to look bad. Two, because, you know, it's an industry that's trying hard to become legal at the moment. So people don't want to say anything that might jeopardize that.
Yeah.
But, you know, like,
but we need to start talking about it, because the whole thing is progressing like this freight train, and we're seeing all these people popping up who think it's all roses and apples and candy, and it's not.
No, that's right. Well, look, the substances that I go into in the book are MDMA, psilocybin, and ayahuasca, which isn't often that talked about in a therapeutic context, but you know, that's something I still have, well, I'm undecided about. Like, it's something I might offer people if they're extremely desperate and on the edge and they need a real reboot and shift.
Yeah.
And for the, and I use a lot of discernment and intuition before I go down that road with somebody. And it is, for me, it's a traumatic experience when I do it, and but it does the job. And you know, so I've kind of lost my train of thought. What were we talking about? Just the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So, look, I think that applies more when you're dealing with something like ayahuasca. But, you know, psilocybin can be pretty full-on as well for a lot of people.
Right.
MDMA you're pretty safe with. But, you know, the odd person finds that traumatic.
I think possibly there's a reason why ayahuasca is not used within the therapeutic framework.
Absolutely.
Is because it really does bring up the shadow, the darkness, and dredge out the stuff. And I think that It's not talking therapy. It's a more a space that needs to be provided to people. Is a kind of space where they can really come to terms with that and work through it with the assistance of the plants and whatever help that they can get in that space. So
absolutely.
I think, and also because it has a traditional or pseudo-traditional framework in South America. So if therapists start using it, you know, the indigenous people who are already kind of upset that all the gringos are sort of doing ayahuasca and all over the world now, they would feel maybe a bit more ripped off that ayahuasca is being used you know, by gringos in that the talking therapy. And I don't know if it could be used easily in talking therapy except in like a low dose. But you don't necessarily, you more hold space for people.
That's right.
Rather than
it's not a talking therapy. No. Like ayahuasca used in a therapeutic context is the talking doesn't happen during the medicine session.
Yeah, yeah.
The talking is in the preparation assessment.
Yeah.
Preparation, preparing people for the reality of what is to come and the integration afterwards. There's very little talking done, as you know, in the medicine session. Ayahuasca does the talking.
Yeah.
She's the therapist. And, you know, and this is where people need experience with the medicine to know that. Like,
yeah.
They need to have drunk the stuff to know that, hey, this is not a place where you talk to people, you know, this is not a place where you interfere with someone's journey. It's a place where you're there to hold space, to make them feel safe, to help them purge, go to the bathroom, play the right music.
So related to the ayahuasca talking, how long did it take for you to come to terms with these kind of concepts that the ayahuasca was
a spirit
that talked to people?
Well, really, one session, right? Like, you drink ayahuasca, you know that straight away.
Right.
I mean, does that happen to everybody?
Like, no.
I don't know, but...
No, some people, probably the minority, and they're very much more probably left-brain people will think that it's more left-brain orientated male... Science intellectual people will think that it's themselves talking to themselves somehow,
right?
Well, contextual it, but I would say your average person kind of gets it, that it's normal, that that's just how it is. Yeah, so for you, that was that a huge paradigm shift for you?
Look, I think I've always ayahuasca calls people, and I think she calls certain types of people. You know, I was a person from a young age. I read Carlos Castaneda when I was like 15 or something,
and
Lobsang Rampa. You know, I was sort of always into that sort of thing.
Yeah, right.
And I guess it wasn't such a great paradigm shift for me, or was it? I don't know. I mean, I was shocked. Let me tell you, like, when the spirit invaded my body for the first time, it's a shocking experience.
It is
like a spirit invading your body. And, you know, I guess even in my book, I'm reluctant to kind of talk about that stuff because unless you've actually done it, you don't really get it. And, you know, I know a lot of people reading my book. I think about people I know, and I know a wide range of people. It does sound pretty woo-woo, but the more people that come out and talk about this stuff, like Graham Hancock and, you know, people with some credibility, then the more people are going to realise that, you know, the Western framework that we live in is very limited.
Yeah, and it's like we can't assume that in any evolutionary time that we know everything, right?
No.
It's completely deluded idea to have. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Of course, there's things that we don't know and we don't understand yet. And people like Dennis McKenna, who did all the pharmacological research on ayahuasca, I mean, he's straight up. Ayahuasca is a total mystery, and he's straight up that ayahuasca is a spirit who talks to him and other people. And that's anyone who does ayahuasca. I mean, I only know one person who's very serious about ayahuasca who doesn't believe that.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I just think the more people that come out, you know, credible people that come out and talk about it, well, you know, we can't all be crazy.
Yeah,
a lot of these people are high up academics and reputable universities you know, we're not all nuts.
Yeah.
So there's got to be something in it. And I needed that. Like, life was so boring before that because, like, what do we do before that? We go to work, we make money, we pay off a mortgage, we live this boring, monotonous life that we do over and over again. Mm-hmm. And yet ayahuasca opens up some magic and some just, you know, like children have that magic living in the moment and living in wonder. And it just somehow ayahuasca just, you know, brings that back.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about trauma, and especially I think I think people interested in particular how MDMA can help people with trauma and what the process is and what that is like for the therapist. And maybe you can go through that and explain how it works and what you've seen personally.
Well, I think the best thing to do is buy the book and read the client's stories, actually, because I can
buy now. Yeah. Amazon and yeah. Barnes and Noble and Gimmicks.
It's not ready yet. 2 weeks, I would say, but it will be by the time this podcast comes out.
Yeah.
I can speak from my own experience is that you don't realize how traumatized you are until it stops. And, you know, because you've lived like that for so long and that hypervigilance, that intense physical tenseness. And, you know, when you take MDMA, it's like, for me, my first MDMA experience was like being, and this doesn't happen to everyone, and I have to be careful saying this because when I talk about my experience, other people think it's going to happen to them and they can get disillusioned. Yep. You know, I've had clients that say, oh, how come I didn't get that lovey, beautiful, you know, whatever. Mm. But I believe you get what you need, you know.
Yeah.
You get what you need. And I needed that. And my first experience was like, you know, I got no insights. I just felt total love. I felt held in the hands of love. I felt compassion for myself. You know, and when you're... you know, and my trauma came from sexual abuse, and I don't mind saying that.
Yeah.
Like half the clients in my book were people that had childhood sexual abuse. So it's full on reading. They're not pretty stories. They're intense, but real reading. And so that's what happened to me. My first MDMA session was beautiful, loving, great, just. But the second one, I got thrust straight back into reliving trauma. So the places it can go are vast and wide, and there's no predictable experience, but it is generally the least traumatic of the medicines to work with for traumatized people.
Yeah.
It's a very heart-opening medicine. It gives you compassion for yourself and for other people. It's just very soothing and calming and, you know, like traumatized people need that.
But in the session, generally how it works is that the person who is traumatized can talk about and to some degree relive their trauma and then reprocess it.
Right, okay. So the process is first you do an assessment, which is about an hour. So you go through that person's history. So you already know a bit about them before you do the medicine session. And they feel comfortable with you because they've met you. They've seen the space where they're going to do the work. So you already know their history. You have a bit of an idea of what will come up. When they do the medicine session, while the medicine is coming on, they're asked to set an intention in the assessment. So they come with an intention for what they actually want to get out of the session. So there's a focus, and that in itself is part of the process, sort of narrowing down, like, well, what do I actually want to get out of this session? So it's a very intuitive process, the actual medicine session. So while the medicine's coming on, which takes from 20 minutes to an hour usually, 40 minutes on average, the initial part is sort of talking and focusing in on the intention and just kind of setting up the space for the session. Then they generally, at about 20 minutes in, I generally will get the person to lie down, put an eye mask on, play music, and there's like a relaxation kind of process that takes place, just getting them to breathe. And, you know, surrender is a big part of the whole process. So depending on the person, some people might want to excavate traumatic memories. They might have blocked stuff out that they want to remember, or they might, you know, it just really depends on the person as to how it unfolds. And that's what I mean. It's an intuitive process. Part of the session will just be going internal and letting them just go with where the medicine takes them. But some people want to delve deeper into things. Some people won't be able to go there on their own without some help. I believe the unconscious has a gatekeeper, which has kept us safe. And the reason that people block things out is that at the time that the trauma happened, those traumatic memories were just too hard to process, like a rape or something. Mm-hmm. The psyche's overwhelmed. Some people actually enter an altered state of consciousness during the trauma, and that's how they block it out. There's a good book called Trust, Surrender, Receive, which is about MDMA therapy, and she basically says that when an intense trauma happens, the person actually enters an altered state of consciousness, and in order to gain access to that memory, you have to enter an induced altered state of consciousness to be able to access that memory. Mm. And that's how psychedelics work, mm. is they enable you to go back into an altered state of consciousness where you know, the unconscious can reveal those memories. Mm. So it just primes the person to be in the right headspace, mm. so that if a therapist can go in and kind of do a bit of excavation, kind of get the guards to stand down, mm. to the unconscious, yeah. and help that person refocus back into the trauma, where it happened, mm. Where they were, what happened, then sometimes they need help to do that. Sometimes they don't need help to do that. It'll mm. just happen.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the people will just have a whole repressed memory come back, okay. and complete full without any help, but mm. they'll know that they repress it. They'll know that it's true. Mm. They'll remember it once they remember it, if you get what I mean. Mm. And mm. then, you know, because if you don't process these memories, it's like Michael Pollan calls it the default mode network. It's like a record stuck in this trauma groove that just mm. keeps going round and round. Mm. And until you can actually access that memory, process it, feel it, and get the trauma out of your body, mm. out of your soul, out of your mind, mm. Then you can't really let that trauma go, yeah. because it's stuck there, yeah. in some, you know, they call it the default mode network.
Yep, yep, yep.
Whatever you call it. It doesn't really matter what you call it.
Mm.
It just matters that you can gain access, yeah. to it. You can, yeah. process it, and you can let it go. Mm. And that's, you know, and once you let something go, it stops being an issue mm. for you.
So what have you seen, and I know the book goes into this, but how would you paraphrase what you've seen in clients, in sessions, and what changes and what it's like for people to let go of trauma and how that affects their life and
their living? I'll give you just an example of one story that's in the book, and this was an ayahuasca session, and it was a fairly full-on one. This woman was a doctor, a young doctor. She just developed this extreme anxiety so bad that she had to leave her job. She became agoraphobic. She couldn't barely leave her house to go to the shops. She started taking some benzos. And she was on the verge of taking antidepressants, which she didn't want to do. This woman had done some other psychedelics. She'd had LSD and mushrooms, but her mum had actually been to Costa Rica and done ayahuasca, so she really wanted to try it. And I felt very intuitively that it would work really well for her.
Mm.
So we did a session, and it was a very traumatic session. She actually relived her birth, in which the umbilical cord was wrapped around her neck.
Oh.
So this was real. She was actually born dying because she was choking mm. on her umbilical cord. Mm. And this is obviously where her trauma came from and where her anxiety came from. But this is removed because you don't have conscious access to that memory, obviously, as a mm. baby. But once she gained access to that memory, and she actually relived it, like she actually mm. relived her birth, she thought she was dying. Mm. She wanted me to take her to hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And but after that session, as traumatic as it was for her, she has no anxiety. She's back at work. She's like living okay. life mm. back at work.
Just one session?
One session.
Is that normal? Do people?
I think it's normal.
For one session to do yep. so much?
Totally.
So do you think that how many sessions do most people need to kind of get the results they're looking for, do you think?
Well, you know, it depends on the medicine that yeah. you use.
Mm.
People have different motivation. They have different, requirements. Like, I guess for me, I'd blocked out a huge chunk of my life. Like, it was completely lost to my memory. And so for me, healing is about having access to your history, knowing who you are and knowing what happened and processing and dealing with that stuff. So, you know, healing means different things to different people. Some people are just happy. Like, I have another client who did one MDMA session. And this is a guy that had sleep paralysis for years. This is a guy that 2 weeks before his session booked into the 41st floor of a hotel and was going to jump.
Oh, wow.
And he got to, like, one step off jumping. And this is a guy who was 5 years sober in AA. And that's where I met him. And he was desperate. One session of MDMA. And this is a therapeutic session. But he now he sleeps 12 hours a night. He used to wake up three times a night with nightmares. I've had people that have had OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, one session and it's gone. So they are miracle medicines. You know, they are miracle medicines. And that's why, like, what can you do?
But one session is not normal for most clients. They need two or three, do you think?
Yeah, they need some people need, like, I've got one guy that's got quite a pretty heavy-duty history of sexual abuse. And what he had a car accident, actually, which was what started this whole process. So one session healed him of his PTSD from his car accident, but then all this other stuff came up. And so he's had about four MDMA sessions, a couple of psilocybin sessions, and he's pretty good to go.
Okay. But there's some people who, you know, keep coming back and they're like, oh, maybe we're not really getting there, or this is a bit much, or, you know, treatment-resistant people, you think?
There's the odd person, and I this is a whole area of research that I think should be done. Like, they don't work for everybody, but they work a bit, if you get what I mean. The worst-case scenario, I've got there's one guy that he's done three MDMA sessions and a psilocybin session. He still gets shifts, but his real issue is alcoholism. So I don't believe that psychedelics, I'm not saying they don't work for alcoholism, but I'm still very pro, you have to do some work. Like, you actually have to want to stop drinking. I've sent this guy off to AA and he's getting a lot out of it. But if you keep self-medicating, whatever work you do is not really going to have long-term benefits. If you know, this is about change. It's about taking action and changing your behaviours. It's not just an instant fix. And I think this is the message that's kind of the false message that's getting out there from the scientific community that, oh, you're going to do a couple of sessions and your life's going to be hunky-dory. But the reality is you do have to change behaviours. You know, you have to choose to stop reacting a certain way. And the psychedelics will give you a help. They'll give you a helping hand and a head start. But if you keep resorting to doing the same behaviours, like...
So how can the integration help people? How do you work with people in the integration phase to help them change their behaviours?
Well, that's exactly what integration is. It is about applying these messages to your life, and it's about... making people take some, not making them, that's a little, you know, like helping people to make changes in their lives, like people that might isolate, for instance, getting them to go out, you know, go and do stuff, go and meet people, go and join a group, do a meetup group, go to a psychedelic society meeting or an AA meeting or like those types of behaviours. Overcoming anxiety, well, you can sit at home and not have to feel anxious, or you can actually face your fears and, you know, there's a lot involved. It depends on the person. It's an individual process. But, you know, it's better than anything we've currently got on offer. But, you know, it's not a magic pill. by any stretch. Well, it is a little bit of a
magic pill. It certainly sounds like it.
It's a magic pill.
It's a little bit of a magic pill.
It's a magic pill.
I'm wondering, as I've talked to other people who do this work with the trauma and MDMA therapy, and they say it can be quite taxing because it's almost like you're experiencing a bit like the worst of humanity.
Yeah.
And you can be quite traumatized in a way by being witness to people's traumas. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. That is so true. And, you know, the trouble with this industry being illegal is when you're doing therapy legally, you generally have a supervisor, someone you can download to, you know, someone that you can kind of go to, and, you know, they're not so readily accessible because of its illegality. And, you know, you mentioned Frederica before, and luckily, you know, as a result of you introducing me to her, she's become a bit of a mentor to me, which has been incredibly helpful. And we have Zoom sessions, and, you know, I can run a few things by her. And you just do have to find people to download to. But the other thing is you have to have breaks. And I think for me, being in AA for so long, I've heard these stories anyway.
Yeah, right.
You know, I've heard so much trauma. Like most people in AA, you know, people don't predominantly become addicted or alcoholic for no reason at all.
You know,
most people are self-medicating trauma, and these people end up in AA. So you hear these stories. Like I'm no stranger to traumatic stories. So I think that's kind of given me a little bit of armor in some way.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing and a bad thing.
But you find it affects you? Like you need to sort of take a few deep breaths after a session, take a few days break, or?
Yeah. And because I've lived through a lot of my own trauma, like, you know.
Could you do a session every day, do you think?
No.
Once a week, twice a week?
A couple of times a week. I've been writing my book, and that's been my focus.
Right,
so I haven't really, you know. I haven't really been focused on.
So I think that's an interesting thing. Like, say if this was to become like a job, it's like, all right, are you going to do this every day of life? You'd burn out, wouldn't you?
Totally.
You'd do it 3 days a week, you'd burn out.
You think? Well, you know, you were just saying, like, you've just done an ayahuasca ceremony. Yeah. How were you feeling after that?
Yeah, it takes, these days, I could do 2 a month.
Yeah.
I could do 2 a month, but there's not much breathing space in that.
Yeah.
I have done 1 a week, but that's like
intense.
That's like a 12-hour, and it's like doing a 12-hour a week job 6 days a week. It's that feeling. You have no space for anything else.
Yeah.
You know? So for me, once a month is the time frame where I feel like I can actually breathe and exist because it's fairly intense.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that unless you've done it, you can't explain to other
people. That's right. Look, I do other, you know, I do phone counseling. I do addiction counseling. So it's interspersed. Like I don't think I've ever done more than like 2 or 3 sessions a week,
right,
you know.
Right.
And that is taxing. So you couldn't do this, I don't think, as a full-time job. As long as you can do the counselling side of it, but the actual medicine work, you couldn't do that every day. But, you know, if you combine it with just general counselling work, integration work, assessments, you know, like – I don't work with anyone unless I do a full assessment with them.
So what do you think that people don't know who are looking on the outside, peering into this more like this psychedelic renaissance sort of like, oh, MDMA can treat trauma. What do people don't know about this kind of work and how it happens, and what maybe do they have not quite right about it?
Well, you know, I think we're kind of covering a lot of that stuff now. You know, I think one thing that people need to know if they're planning on doing this work is you have to do a lot of self work. You know, I'm older than the average psychonaut. Like, you know, you have to do a lot of self work, and you have to do a lot of medicine work.
Yeah.
Like, you know, as a person in recovery, the only reason I really have done a lot of medicine work is because I'm working with it, and I know, you know, you have to do your own work, and you have to understand where the medicine takes people to know how to work with it. So, you know, it's not about having a MDMA session and a mushroom session and you're good to go.
No.
You know.
So your book goes into, it gives some advice to people who want to get into this work, some guidelines and advice. So what would you say to people who want to get started in doing this? What would you recommend that they do? How would they, what's the best way to move forward into really getting into this, do you think?
Well, are you talking about legally or illegally?
Either or.
Well, they're two different journeys, I think.
I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe.
I would say buy my book because there's a whole.
Come on, I'll offer us some pearly gems of wisdom. You know?
Okay, I'll just give you an idea. The book's in three parts, okay? So the first part's aimed at clients who want to do this work, who are considering doing the work, how to go about finding a safe therapist slash facilitator. Yeah, yeah. The second part is client stories, and the third part is for therapists and facilitators who want to get into this field. So really it's a how-to, you know, it's a how do you go about doing psychedelic therapy? Who should do psychedelic therapy? What states people can get into doing psychedelic therapy, and how best to work with them? And things that can go wrong, you know, and these are the things that aren't talked about. Yeah. So, and there's also a chapter on resources and good, you know, good books to read to help you. But really the main thrust is like about how to do a proper assessment, how to do medicine work, how to do integration work. Look, I think, you know, it's a calling. I don't know how normal people do this work. I only know how I ended up here by a complete synchronicity.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't plan it. I didn't even really want to do it, but I felt obliged to help people. And that might sound a little codependent, but it's not. You know, I'm not a Cody, right? Far from it. I'm quite selfish. I just know that when I see people about to kill themselves and I have a solution, that I have to make that available to them. Yeah. And if the law's not going to do that, we have to do it. You know, we just have to take responsibility and do it.
Mm.
When you know there's a solution, you just can't in good conscience watch people in despair.
So when you started, was there any particular reading or what really inspired you, or the guidelines and resources that you found most useful?
Well, that's a good question. Like, I started with ayahuasca because you encouraged me to, Julian. That was a big mistake.
No, it was a learning experience.
It was a big learning experience. So, no, I was inspired by the magic and what happened to me. And so I went and co-facilitated with a few different people. I went and drank with a few different people, you know, yourself included. I asked a lot of questions. I probably hounded you to death.
Heatseeker Dale, Dale's username.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I went and picked the plants and I learned how to make the medicine, and I went and co-facilitated with other people. I hounded them to death, probably. And it just opened up, you know, and then, you know, like I started tentatively doing it with one-on-one with a few people. I only did it with people that had already done it before.
Yeah.
I just got confidence. I got confirmation in my own medicine work that I should be doing this work. I was more against it than for it. Like, it scares the shit out of me, to be quite honest. Ayahuasca does anyway. It really does. Like, I'm au fait with doing MDMA and psilocybin work because, you know, like, I look at ayahuasca as the SAS training, that, you know, that is SAS, military training.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know, it's a calling, and I don't think many people will last long, to be honest. Yeah.
What about resources? Oh, right.
Well, like, for MDMA.
What did you read and what did you find that really helped you in terms of information?
Well, Frederica's book helped me. MAPS therapist training manual helped.
Yeah.
That's a good resource. That's more MDMA focused, but they have a therapist training manual, which is pretty available on their website. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to pay for it.
Yeah.
And there are a few other good resources that I've mentioned in the book, and offhand I can't quite remember what they are, but predominantly, you know, Frederick has been doing this work probably longer than anybody else. She's done it for 30 years, plus she's a doctor and a psychotherapist. She's drunk. She's had all these medicines herself. Her and her husband go off to Brazil, and
they're amazing. They go off and do everything.
Yeah,
and they're in their 70s.
Yeah,
and they're such awesome people.
Absolutely, you know? She's a total inspiration. And because she actually got busted doing this work, she was able to write her book. Yeah. And her book is, you know, it's very beneficial.
Yeah.
I already knew a lot about trauma and PTSD. I mean, I've got a psychology degree, and I'm a qualified addiction counsellor, so I mainly focus on trauma because it's relevant to me and they're the people I come across.
It'd be great if Frederica would do some sort of training for people, because I think her contribution is sort of necessary in the world. There's lots of people who kind of wanting to step into this, and it's all a little bit theoretical at the moment, where she's got a lot of hands-on nuts and bolts experience over many years.
Absolutely.
So I think she's the real elder at the moment.
Totally.
I can't think of anyone else offhand.
I mean, she's taken all these medicines herself. She's trained with psychedelic therapists when it was legal back in, you know, she lives in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And there was a guy, I can't remember his name offhand, who was training people to do psychedelic therapy. Mm. So she is a font of information. You know, and I guess that's how it works. If you're open, you're curious, and you want to know, you know, go to APS meetings, pick people's brains, like go and do. I had to go and do ayahuasca ceremonies with different people.
Yeah.
You know, I've drunk with different people, learnt what I could from them. You know, I don't know.
So do you think some people might not be suited to doing this work? what are the mistakes that people could make? What are the sort of like, What are the issues that you can see that people could, how could people kind of fuck it up? Sorry, kids.
Oh, golly. I have to think about that. Underground. We'll talk about underground because that's what's happening right now, I think. You know, I think if you do your own medicine work, that will be your guidance, because I know for me personally, I wouldn't go to a therapist who hadn't been through trauma and experienced it. I think that this is our new elite in a way. Like, I know there's a lot of emphasis in the scientific community on qualifications, and you have to be a doctor and you've got to be this.
That's
and
all ridiculous.
A psychiatrist. Yeah. Like, I couldn't think of anything, anyone worse.
No, they should stay away. We should just not, they should not be serving anything.
Well, and that's a generalization. I mean, obviously, some people get into psychology psychiatry because they do have a genuine interest.
No, they do have an interest in the human mind, but I think you're right. It is really in doing it yourself that you understand the medicines you work with and how they work with you. And I think that you really learn by doing it and sharing it with people. And ultimately, it's like, say you're a doctor, you don't really learn how to be a doctor until you start doing your, what do they call it, the internship, and they actually start treating patients and know how to deal with patients and the real realities on the boots on the ground.
Yeah. You know? And it's the same with trauma. If you've experienced PTSD, you know what it's like. You know what happens to people. Mm. Like, you can't explain. It's like telling someone about sexual abuse. Talking about it, reading about it, gives you no real insight to what the experience
people
was.
People who don't have trauma, maybe they are perhaps not as informed or suitable to treat people who have trauma, do you think?
Well, you know, once again, that's a bit of a generalization too. Mm. I think there are, like, people like, I guess, you know, the trauma kind of specialist, Bessel van der Kolk, like people like that, that he is becoming very interested in psychedelic therapy. And yeah. I see his name popping up in psychedelic kind of conferences and stuff yeah. now. Yeah. Like he's a guy that's, you know, he's a trauma supposed expert and an academic. So like someone like him that has been working with traumatized people and the likes of people like that will have a good insight into what happens to traumatized people because they've been studying it. But I also think there's a role for traumatized people to really step up and empower themselves to know that, you know, as I said at the start, you can turn your lemons into lemonade. Mm. You know, that the fact that you've been traumatized and you've overcome it, mm. That gives you kind of superpowers to help other people that. So, you know, it's not all – I think the whole matrix is changing in regard to what society should reward and, you know, that whole academic credibility is not the gold standard anymore. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah,
when it comes to psychedelic therapy, it's not anywhere.
No, I definitely think that really what should be happening, and I've talked about this before on this podcast, is that the people who are – they really should be looking to the underground, the people actually doing this, and that's where the learning and the information should be filtering up to the overground. So what do you think – you know, we're looking at this kind of strange situation in the coming years. How do you see things – moving forward in the world in Australia, what are things looking like to you?
Oh, look, I'm traumatized at the moment. Like, I just, for everyone who's listening, like, this is flood zone Queensland. We've got floods at the moment. We've got the Ukrainian bloody war going on. We've got COVID.
Apocalyptic times. This podcast is called Revelations is because. You know, we're living in these strange apocalyptic times and, you know, we want to sort of...
Rak Razam gave us 10 years, a decade, so it's like, don't even work. Just go and travel and have fun. And especially if you've been traumatized, just don't do it. Like, just go and have fun.
Right.
Like, I don't know what's going to happen. It's probably going to be a shit show. I don't like what's happening with all this capitalism getting involved and... turning this into a commodity. I think it's quite disgusting.
How can we look at this story and maybe how can we address what might be unfolding as psychedelics and capitalism converge? What do you think we need to be aware of and be wary of? What are you seeing there?
Well, I think as someone mentioned, Maria Sabina said, the medicines will stop working. I think that will happen.
Yeah.
I think the medicines will stop working and some, you know, I've seen it happen anyway in ceremony. If you, particularly ayahuasca, well, you know way more about it than I do, Julian. I'm a relative newcomer to that space. But, like, I've been in ceremonies where if someone comes in there, like, out of 14 people, there was one guy and his intention was so wrong and I can't even remember all the details now, but, like, oh, I just want to give it a go because everyone else is doing it. And, you know, he was the one guy. Ayahuasca didn't work for him both nights it worked for everybody else. So I believe these things do have a spirit and they're a bolshy spirit, particularly ayahuasca. I don't know. I don't know if that really answers the question, but look, I don't know. I stay in my own lane really, Julian. Yeah. I don't really get into, I guess AA's taught me that. It's like, you know, the serenity prayer, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. And I kind of live by that. Look, I can't change a lot of stuff that's going on out there. All I can do is stay in my lane and help the people that are presented to me. You know, I haven't gone down that whole track about analyzing what's going to happen or how it's going to be, because I just do what I do. And I have my own struggles in doing that. You know, I worry about getting busted. I worry about a lot of things. And, you know, I just, as long as I can lie in bed at night and sleep straight, then I just take care of my own backyard and let everyone else do all the fighting. And, you know, I'm not investing in psychedelics. I don't want to make money out of them.
Yeah.
You know, look, I've spent a lot of my life just trying to stay alive, to be honest. So
But you put your book out, you've put your you've put your best feet forward, and you're coming out, as it were.
I'm coming out. Look what you've done to me, man. I can't believe I'm even doing this. This is like next level to me.
And soon you'll be doing a book tour of the United States of America.
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is this is a synchronicity and things lining up. Like, the guy that's editing, or who edited my book, I found him. You know, these are the synchronicities that start happening. You know, he's drunk ayahuasca. And how do you find an editor out of all of these people that have, I suppose a lot of people have drunk ayahuasca now, but, you know, even in the work I do, like, I meet a psychologist sitting next to me on the plane and we get talking. And she ends up referring me all these clients, and she's been off to Peru to do ayahuasca. Like, these are the synchronicities that start happening.
So basically, this book is pretty much unique. Like, there's not other books that I'm aware of where underground therapists actually talk about their clients, except when they're written completely anonymously. So what inspired you to do this in this way, so publicly? What is your...
I think insanity, actually.
Maybe you're divinely inspired.
Oh, you know? Look, you know, I don't know. Look, I tell you how it happened was that, because after every person I work with, I send out a research form afterwards. Because I am a writer, I've written a lot of stuff, and I want to know how it's affecting people. I want to know if this work is working for people. So I developed a research form, which I send out to every client, and they send them back. So I had all this information and all these profound healings that in people's own words. And, you know, I asked them if I could use them, and then it kind of grew from there, really. But I, you know, it's very anxiety provoking, even publishing this book. I think, what the hell am I doing, really? But, like, I don't know, what will be,
We're only got 10 years anyway, so.
Yeah, like, I'm old. If they want to put me in jail, then so be it. Like, it'll be another adventure, no doubt. If Frederic can do it, Frederica, so can I.
So what's next for you, Dale, do you think?
Oh, I don't know, to be honest. I think when this book comes out, whatever opens up, I live in the day, and I need a break, to be honest. I'd like to go on a holiday. And I don't know. Like, more will be revealed, as they say. And I kind of live in that space now. It's like, more will be revealed. And, you know, I think if you're doing the right thing and you're living in the flow and the medicines want to work with you, then the way shall open up. So, to be honest, more will be revealed.
Yes, like the Red Sea.
What about you, Julian? What are you going to do next?
What am I going to do? Lots of things. I'm going to travel to West Africa. I'm going to go to India, do Panchakarma. I'm going to, see where my dreaming leads me.
Yeah, so you do the same, really.
Yeah.
You live in the moment.
Yeah.
And you just follow your nose.
That's right.
Yeah. And more will be revealed,
that's
right?
That's it.
Yeah. Cool.
I think that's it. I think we covered the ground.
I think so. Yeah. I'm a bit tired after all that talking.
Yeah.
Now I have to go and find somewhere to hide. Oh, dear.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dale.
Thanks. Over and out.